So my talk today is a little bit different from the other panelists. I'm doing a talk today on my concept analysis paper that I presented for my comprehensive exams about a year ago. So I have no disclosures, no relationships to disclose. And before I start, I wanted to share a little bit about who I am and where I come from. And that's a little bit, I guess it's very important for us as Native people. So here are some pictures of my mom and my dad. This is on their wedding day. And my siblings, my older sister, Lei, my middle sister, Pua, and then myself. I also have an older brother. In our culture, we adopt other family members. So my brother is actually my second cousin. So he's the oldest of us all. And then at the bottom picture here is a picture of my mom and my sisters and our niece, Rachel. She's 15 years old now, and she's a typical teenager. So. But my reason I got interested into healthcare was because my mom and my dad both have chronic diseases. My mom is diabetic, and my dad died of a massive heart attack in 1995. So since the age of 12, I kind of was pushed in the direction of healthcare, and I started to become the primary caregiver for family members in my family. So the objectives of today's talk is to describe the concept analysis of Native Hawaiian spirituality, present the concept of e'olopono, or Native Hawaiian spirituality, and to share a little bit about the impact that this has for caring for Native Hawaiians. So for many of us, spirituality is part of our culture. It's very deeply rooted, and it stems back to our cultural values and beliefs. The paper uses the Rogers Evolutionary View methodology, which looks at things over time. And so how I'm going to present the concept analysis is in three time periods that are very significant to Native Hawaiian people. So this is a little bit about the actual methodology used. So Rogers Evolutionary View, if you're not familiar with it, comes from the naturalistic paradigm, so looking at things as it occurs in time. And specifically, there are multiple steps to the process, but in the second step, the area of use is the concept analysis. So this is a little bit about the process that was used to do the concept analysis. So the first thing that was done, of course, with any concept analysis was to do a literature review. Now, because a lot of, to understand Native Hawaiian spirituality is to understand the historical aspects of the people. So looking at 40 years worth of literature that was available to me, I did a literature search in the University of Hawaii catalog, and then also did some searches in the PubMed, Academic Search Premier, and CINAHL. I looked at multiple disciplines because I felt that it was important to gain an aspect of the historical aspects, the behavioral health aspects, as well as nursing and medicine as well, and social work, and of course public health. So this is the three areas that I focused my concept analysis on. So pre-1778 is a time period before Captain Cook's arrival. To me, it was defined as a time where spirituality is constantly interwoven into life. The second time period of 1778 to 1874 is a time of transition for Native Hawaiian people. In 1778, like I mentioned, is when Cook arrived to Hawaii. And in 1874 is when the monarchy changed. So 1874 to present is what I define as spirituality as being reborn. So a little bit about each of the time periods. Now, in pre-1778, this is a time before Cook. So as you know, Native Hawaiians were long-distance voyagers. We came from an ancestral land called Kahiki. Most people will associate that with Tahiti. So from 500 AD, we arrived to this archipelago in the middle of the Pacific, and there was nothing for miles around us. So that process ended about 1200 AD, at least that's what historically is said. And with those, we brought over traditions from our ancestral lands, and I'll share a little bit about each one of those things. So we have three, or actually more than three, creation stories, but these are the three that I looked at. I looked at Kumulipo, which is a genealogical chant that traces ourselves back to the creation of time. Kalo is something that is another creation story about how man came to be, and it talks about how our ancestor Kalo, or Haloa, is our brother, and so it teaches us the lesson that we should care for that person, or for caring for other, for one another. And then Ha is an exchange of breath, or an exchange of life, so Ha is very important to us. So this is a picture of what Taro looks like, and then our goddess Pele from the volcano, I think this is from the volcano house in Big Island. So some of the cultural beliefs and values that were in pre Western contact and carries on to today include pono, which means to be, remain steadfast, lokahi, unity, ohana, family, and then to understand the sense of place. So as I opened, I shared a little bit about where I come from and where I'm headed. And then of course this connection called triple piko to the past, present, and the future. In ancient times, we were guided by a set of rules called the Ihikafu. These rules actually told us how to live. Well, I shouldn't say told us, just like guided us as to how to live our life. So there were strict rules within each land division. A chief ruled the land, and then the people worked the land. And we had to maintain balance and order within that period. There's also a period, and within that structure, there's this thing called palua or dualism. So for everything, for every one thing, there's an opposite or a complement. So for example, we have a god of peace, which is god of Lono, and then a god of war, so Ku. And right now we're in the wet season, so we would be in our Makahiki festivals, and it would be the time of Lono or peacefulness. We just ended the time of Ku. It also governed our agriculture and our fishing. So, you know, there's land foods and there's ocean foods. We were also practiced, or back then they practiced this thing called aikapu, which is eating laws, and men and women did not eat together. Men and women ate separately from one another and only consumed foods that were allowed to be consumed by their gender. And I'll talk a little bit more about how in 1819 this came to an end. There's also this types of illness and health in the ancient times. Well, you know, we didn't have much disease back then. We believed in illness, but not disease, in the sense that illness was a result of something. So Ma'i Amakua was an illness or sickness caused by the gods, and it could only be, you could only be healed by it if you had a kahuna who could pray over you and take care of you, and if your family did certain things. And then there's also body sickness, or Ma'ikino, which is body sickness, and those types of illnesses were treatable by herbal practices. So the next time period of 1778 to 1874 is a time of constant change for people. In 1819, the kapu ended, so remember I mentioned about the aikapu and the ihikapu, so those things came to an end. And how it came to an end was an act, a simple act of our monarch, King Kamehameha II, having a meal with his kuhina nui, the regent, Kaahumanu. So that, of a simple act like that, the kapu ended. And then about 11 months later, the missionaries arrived. So I'm gonna share a little bit more in detail about different things. So the Christianity, like with any other indigenous cultures, came in. For Hawaiians, they came in to Hawaii around 1820, which was an ideal time because we were in a period of chaos. For lack of a better word, we're in a period of chaos. We no longer adhered to things of the past. We were now looking towards this other future. Our first ruling monarch, King Kamehameha I, who united the island nations, died in 1819. And then in 1820, like I mentioned, the new religion came. They weren't granted permission necessarily immediately to come and settle. There was a period of, you know, getting to know one another, and then they were allowed to settle in Kailua Kona and then in Honolulu. There was also this time where, during this time period, a privatization of land. So a lot of our ancestors, you know, we cultivated the land and we worked the land, we cared for the land, but there was a sense of, well, you know what, I need to make more money, I need to go into the urban center. So transition period of going from rural settings to more urbanized setting, and then with that comes with lifestyle change. So not just, you know, our ancestors experienced it then and we're still experiencing it now. So this last time period of 1874 to the present marks a cultural renaissance. So in 1874, King Kalakaua, also known as the Merry Monarch, came into power. So the Kamehameha dynasty had ended about 2 years prior to that, and then the Hawaiian people decided to vote or elect their king, and King Kalakaua was he was the second elected king, if I'm not mistaken. But in 1874, he came to power. In 1893, there was an overthrow, and then in 1970, there was another cultural renaissance. So with Kalakaua, we were able to revitalize things of the past. So we were able to bring back hula, the musical arts and to bring back Oli. So Native Hawaiians who used to not practice openly were now allowed to practice openly. He sponsored many occasions to have parties at the Iolani Palace, and he was known, therefore, as the Merry Monarch. So today we celebrate with the Merry Monarch Festival, which is held about 2 weeks after Easter. In the 1970s, there was also another period of cultural rediscovery. So people, the Native Hawaiian people, so the state of Hawaii became a state in 1959. So 11 years go by, and the people are now realizing, hey, there's a lot of things that were done wrong to us. We need to start doing something about this. We need to have a voice. So probably in the early 1970s, they had the Constitution Convention, which identified Hawaiian as an official language of Hawaii, and it also created the Office of Hawaiian Affairs. People were starting to also advocate for the land rights, the misuse of certain lands. So water rights in our wet areas were being challenged, and then we were also fighting to bring back or stop the bombing of Kahoʻolawe, which was an island that was used as a target practice. Another momentous occasion happened when the Hokulea had their maiden voyage in 1976 from Hawaii to Tahiti. So it proved to the world that Native Hawaiians were long-distance voyagers, that we were able to do this. And at the bottom picture is actually the three voyaging canoes. I don't know all of their names, but one of them is Hokulea, and then the other two are the other long-distance voyaging canoes that are part of that society. So a few years ago, they also did one back to Micronesia to honor Maupialog, who recently passed away. So, you know, this revitalization amongst our people to understand the past and the present. So just really briefly, for lack of time, I just wanted to touch about the health belief model and how it relates to Eolopono. So this model is conceptualized by myself, but it was actually teachings of other people such as Auntie Malia Craver and Kekuni Blaisdell and many others. But it's a combination of two values. So the value of Lokahi and the value of the Triple Pico. So in the center of the triangle is a person, and that person's relationship with all things such as God, man, and the land. So there's that connection between all three. And then our responsibility to understand the past in order to live in the present and to protect the future. So in this model, it builds on the health belief model. And what's added to this is that there's an outer circle that binds it all together, because our culture is collectivistic in nature. So we don't care just for ourselves. It's not about who I am and where I'm going. It's about where we are going collectively as a people. So that's very important to us. So, and it reflects on our person time orientation. So Eolopono means life in balance. So spirituality is rooted in culture and religion, and it's an integral part to health and well-being of our people. It's integrated into our programs, and spirituality continues to live in daily life. So to share a little bit about what I've done with, well, how I came to come to this concept was that working for a Native Hawaiian healthcare agency, I had to understand, well, you know, I am Native Hawaiian, but I also had to understand that, you know what are some of the other things people go through? And so when I look at programs and how we deliver programs, I always am constantly reminded about our cultural values and how that plays a role into how well people participate or why they participate. So in conclusion, I wanted to share that evolution of Native Hawaiian spirituality was initially based on culture. It then migrated over to religion, but then now it's a part of who we are, and it's part of our cultural identity and a way of life. Thank you, and that's my contact. You're welcome.
Hi, my name is
Naylin
Wang, and I am a professor and a school advocate. Can I have a question for the last speaker?
Yes.
Compare those people who actually practice this model, to incorporate, if we ask that question, like, how would this better be better delivered to you? And most of the time it goes back to the values of people and incorporating those values into how we conduct our research. So we also, a lot of the times we understand that because of the collective nature, we more are engaged in a social support network. So working with people in a group model rather than an individual model works best. Because people tend to learn from one another, and that's part of how we became, we become people and better ourselves. So as for whether or not it's had a positive impact, I'm not really sure because I've never really focused the study on that specific question. But I know Nelly might be able to add something to that. She has done work with quantitative numbers and how maybe culture impacts them.
It's hard to answer that if the role of the model is a better model in the white context, because if being surrounded by a dominant culture, it hasn't been able to sustain itself in isolation. I think that's the experience of many indigenous cultures throughout the world, that they have a good level of health, given that they have available resources. But when a dominant culture comes, Western-based culture comes in, their health behaviors change, and they're going from a much more healthier lifestyle and eating pattern and socialization pattern to something that's very conflicting. And I think the disparities start becoming very acute the more Westernization intrudes into their culture.
Or is that to counter that trend, because the intensity was a huge issue when they started the obesity fighting program a couple of years ago in 2017. And so have you guys been able to counter, or, you know, once they go back to their cultural values, things change. And have you been able to do that, or?
In programs that have been based on traditional practices and values, the study of Fido Hana, which is a weight loss maintenance program, has been very successful. We're also at the medical school, we're involved in looking at land food health. We're going to another session. So combining diabetes self-management with a return to the land with a communal gardening, and that has been showing very powerful effects. So in isolation, we do find that these programs, when you incorporate a cultural-based approach, and can be very powerful in the adherence, in attention. Thank you.
Lots to think about there. I also wanted to mention that I'm in a couple of things from our other presentations as well. I was amazed, Mimi, at the scope of your research, the sheer breadth of your work and the expanse of data that you've been able to collect. I think it's really amazing. I think it's something that we often, as nurses, aren't really focused on. The large notion of these kinds of research data sets is really helpful.
Well, it's a collaborative. I mean, it's probably 6 or 7 PIs from the university.
I'm sure it takes that many, at least. But I'm struck by how we have this rich description of one culture and its transitions over time, and then this notion of collecting this huge amount of data as kind of bookending this really important cultural competency work. And both of the Baldwins, this has been sort of fun, added a lot in terms of, I think, the communication skills that were inherent in both of your presentations. And I'm always humbled by the fact that technology, for me, sometimes creates a little barrier. And you convinced me otherwise trustee. That maybe there's hope for me when I retire. I'll have time to do all of this. But I really want to thank you. I also just want to mention that when Sarah introduced herself, she mentioned very clearly that she was an advanced practice public health nurse, and it is exciting to me that we identify ourselves as such, and that this breadth of work that's been represented today is all a part of our specialty. So, does anybody have additional questions? Yes, please.
I have a question for Dr. Ball. With the, you said you did a record musician.
Yeah.
What was his role? Did he already see the message?
No, not yet. One of the things I don't know if I mentioned it earlier, but one of the things that we actually are doing is collecting that preliminary data that you have to have when you submit a lot of trials. And we wanted data to show how music really can inform and provide breast health messages. Now, Stephen's role is to actually take the message itself, like he'll look at breast health, like mammograms, the importance of getting a mammogram, the importance of doing clinical breast exams, seeing your doc, all those kinds of things. He will craft that into type of lyric, some kind of song. And we're looking at somewhere between like a 1 minute and 2 minute song. He has done this with other NIH studies with HIV, and where they're using music to actually deliver whatever message that they're trying to deliver. So that's his role, is to actually develop all of the lyrics, the lines, and the beat, and those kinds of things.
Would it be on the internet?
Yeah. It's on the internet. And he's also, by the way, just got a contract with the White House and working with the First Lady on obesity and children. But he's putting the music together.
Yes. Thank you. Yes.
I have a question for the last presenter. So you mentioned music, and I, from my experience with Indigenous populations, music and dance have always been an essential part of health. Yeah. So how has that been incorporated into some of the projects you've been involved in?
So one of the, we have, I can't remember when we just started,
mm-hmm. think the arts are something that research is beginning to show that so much can be accomplished through the arts. So it's going to be interesting to see what kind of partnerships lie ahead. Who knew? I have just started working with somebody who just got a master's degree in community art, and we're doing lots of partnership activities. They're doing murals and storm drain paintings and public and environmental health strategies. So I think there's lots of potential in the arts, and I'm struck by what you said about the positive message as opposed to the fear messages that we often project in public health. Thank you.